From this point on, Yeats became a poet of the world, attuned not only to Ireland's frequently mythologized past, but to its place in history, and ultimately, he became concerned with the fate of man in the universe. This is what earned him the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1923. It is also what deepened his tragic sense and further emboldened him to champion the pride and talent of the Irish in what he called their very Irishry. He had already been president of the National Literary Society both in London and Dublin, and had founded the Abbey Theatre, where the work of Irish playwrights was staged with Irish actors. Unlike Beckett and Joyce, who drew their literary maps of Ireland as exiles, Yeats remained on the island and built what would never have been created, it is widely conceded, without his personal intervention. In the end, he became a true Irish hero, serving, as he wrote of Jonathan Swift, not his own ambition, but human liberty. In this spirit, Yeats, together with Lionel Johnson, addressed himself to the importance of poetry as our spiritual oxygen in public as well as private life. He claimed repeatedly that life was a mystery to be lived, not a problem to be solved. The same insistence is present in this passage from a speech he gave entitled Poetry and Freedom.
Three types of men have made all beautiful things. Aristocracies have made beautiful manners because their place in the world puts them above the fear of life. And the countrymen have made beautiful stories and beliefs because they have nothing to lose and do not fear. And the artists have made all the rest because Providence has filled them with recklessness. All these look backward to a long tradition. For being without fear, they have held to whatever pleased them. The others, being always anxious, have come to possess little that is good in itself, and always changing from thing to thing. For whatever they do or have must be a means to something else. And they have so little belief that anything can be an end in itself that they cannot understand you if you say, all the most beautiful things are useless. They prefer the stalk to the flower and believe that painting and poetry exist that there may be instruction, and love that there may be children, and theaters that busy men may rest, and holidays that busy men may go on being busy. At all times they fear and even hate the things that have worth in themselves, for that worth may suddenly, as it were a fire, consume their book of life, where the world is represented by ciphers and symbols, and before all else, they fear irreverent joy and unserviceable sorrow.
Yeats's defense of the necessity of the arts in public life was not confined to rhetoric. He was a poet who practiced what he preached. He wrote numerous poems about the nature of poetry itself, and he wrote poems in praise of other poets as well. In a poem called Adam's Curse, Yeats admits that poets, like all men everywhere, must work out their destinies by the sweat of their brows. Adam's curse. But he quickly adds that the fruit of such poetic labor must never be perceived as labor, must never give the impression of heaviness, of something belabored. On the contrary, he suggests that art at its best is when it seems effortless and artless, just as love at its best is when it is least conscious of itself. He even goes on to say in the poem that poetry and love in the truest sense seem to rhyme when they achieve a certain indefinable lightness of being, no matter how temporary that may be.
We sat together at one summer's end, that beautiful, mild woman, your close friend, and you and I, and talked of poetry. I said, a line will take us hours, maybe, yet if it does not seem a moment's thought, our stitching and unstitching has been naught. Better go down upon your marrow bones and scrub a kitchen pavement or break stones like an old pauper in all kinds of weather. For to articulate sweet sounds together is to work harder than all these, and yet be thought an idler by the noisy set of bankers, schoolmasters, and clergymen the martyrs call the world. And thereupon that beautiful, mild woman, for whose sake there's many a one shall find out all heartache on finding that her voice is sweet and low, replied, to be born a woman is to know, although they do not talk of it at school, that we must labor to be beautiful. I said, it's certain there is no fine thing since Adam's fall that needs much laboring. There have been lovers who thought love should be so much compounded of high courtesy that they would sigh and quote with learned looks precedence out of beautiful old books. Yet now it seems an idle trade enough. We sat grown quiet in the name of love. We saw the last embers of daylight die, and in the trembling blue-green of the sky, a moon, worn as if it had been a shell, washed by time's waters as they rose and fell about the stars and broke in days and years. I had a thought for no one's but your ears, that you were beautiful, and that I strove to love you in the old highway of love, that it had all seemed happy, and yet we'd grown as weary-hearted as that hollow moon.